Support for the World's podcast comes from Goldman Sachs. To learn about developments currently shaping markets, industries, and the global economy, subscribe to the firm's podcast, Exchanges at Goldman Sachs, available on iTunes and Stitcher.
Simply genius. Today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. The MacArthur Foundation has chosen the recipients for its genius grants. One of them is a lawyer working on immigration reform.
It doesn't take a genius to figure out that if you have a 10-year-old child in a courtroom against a trained prosecutor, if you want to give the child a fair hearing, you should probably give them a lawyer.
Plus, a sick American was killed 4 days after 9/11. 15 years later, the man who killed him tries to explain why.
Don't think for one minute because I'm here in prison that I'm an evil man. I'm a good man.
And a vegan prepares to take a bite out of a veggie burger that even bleeds.
It's a little weird, the idea of biting into a slab of meat-like substance.
Those stories are coming up today here on The World. Glad you could be with us this Friday. Forgive, but don't forget. So goes the expression. Definitely easier said than done. How do you forgive and really mean it when, for example, someone has murdered someone you love? Earlier this week, we heard about Balbir Singh Sodhi, a sick American man from Phoenix who was killed just a few days after 9/11. He was gunned down at the gas station he owned. His killer thought Balbir was Muslim because he wore a turban. In the years since, Balbir's brother, Rana, has made it his mission to talk to people, to help them understand and be more tolerant. Balbir's story also deeply affected Valerie Kaur. We spoke with her a few weeks ago. She's a lawyer who became an activist after 9/11, and she's become close to the Sodhi family. Last week, the day after the 15th anniversary of Balbir's death, she and his brother Rana got on the phone with Balbir's killer, who's in prison, and they recorded the conversation.
Hello, is this Frank?
Yes, this is.
Hello, Frank. My name is Valerie.
Okay.
I'm a family friend of the Sodhi family. And I've been trying to speak with you for many years, so I'm really grateful that you said yes, because I'm sitting here with Rana Sodhi. Rana is the younger brother of Balbir Singh Sodhi. We wanted to call you 15 years later in this spirit of healing.
I have Valerie Kaur with us. It is extraordinary to listen to this conversation, Valerie, and we'll hear some more excerpts in a moment. It must have been painful as well as somewhat cathartic to talk with the man who killed your friend. Why did you want to do this, and why on the 15th anniversary of 9/11 and Balbir's death?
Every year on September 15th, the Sodhi family holds a memorial at the gas station. And while it is beautiful, as I was arriving, I felt just extreme fatigue that in all these years, the memorials now blur together. That for 15 years, we have been trapped in a cycle of violence since 9/11, a terrorist attack followed by a wave of hate violence, increased racial profiling, surveillance, detentions, deportations, and then followed by another terrorist attack. And the cycle starts again. And when I looked at Rana Sodhi, Balbir's younger brother, I could see that he was tired too. He told me, it feels like nothing has changed. You know, we've made films, we published books, we've marched in the street, we've created organizations, but 15 years of activism have not made our community safer, especially this election season. So Rana and I had been talking about this idea of revolutionary love as the antidote to hate. The idea that we ought to look upon the faces of people who don't look like us and see them as brothers and sisters. And we asked ourselves, well, what does that mean to look upon even the face of someone who has taken everything from us, to look upon Frank Roque's face and say, brother, you were lost. You did what you did out of a lack of love, but we still call you brother. And so I asked Rana if he would be willing to call Frank Roque with me. He's sitting in a Arizona prison just some miles away from the gas station, and he said yes.
Let's hear your conversation with Frank Roque.
I've always told the truth about what happened to me, which caused me to do what happened to your loved one. The events of 9/11 so broke me down as a man that I could not control what happened. I want you, and especially his brother, to understand that I was a man that was married for 15 years at that time, devoted to supporting my family through hard work, just like Balbir. I would have never have done what happened of my own free will. What happened was a result of a mental breakdown over the events of that 9/11. How could people crash planes full of people into buildings full of people? And after seeing that over and over, it took its toll on me. And I'm sad to say, and I'm sorry to say, that was the end result of what I ended up doing.
You know, we were all watching the towers fall. Balbir Sodhi was also watching the towers fall. He also felt grief, right? But there are different ways to channel that pain. And I know you chose violence. And I want to know if you have anything you want to say directly to his brother about the life that you took from him.
The only thing I could say is I'm sorry for what happened to his brother, as I'm sorry for what happened to the innocent other people that died on that, you know, on the 9/11. We all have to be sorry for that also.
Absolutely. The spot where Balbir Sodhi died, there's a plaque, and it says that we mourn everyone who died on 9/11. And Frank, there's no question that we mourn the thousands on 9/11, no question. But we're talking to you to start thinking about forgiveness for the life that you took.
I do, believe me, I do. I'm not a callous man. I'm a man, I'm a religious man also. And I prayed to God for forgiveness for what I have done, and God has forgiven me for what I have done. And I express to you remorse for what I have done. And to his brother, I express this remorse.
Frank, I'm hearing you. I'm so thankful and what you say. And I'm so glad today you feel regret. You feel sorry. Because everybody made a mistake.
I want you to know one other thing. In addition to being sorry to you, especially to his wife and the whole family of yours, one day when I pass, I'm getting old now. I'm 50, almost 58, with a bad heart. One day when I go to heaven to be judged by God, I will ask to see your brother, and I will hug him, and I will ask him for forgiveness.
We already forgave you. You know, in the beginning, and the media asked me, and when the jury find you a death penalty, and I told the media, I don't want to take his life. This is not my Sikh religion teach me to taking somebody's life. He made a mistake. He will regret someday, because my brother was the nicest person in this earth. His death changed my life. His death changed Valerie's life. His death changed so many people's life.
What an intense exchange, Valerie. You hoped it would be healing. How healing was it, and how much did it bring resolution for you and Rana to the killing of Balbir?
After the call was done, we just sat in stunned silence. You know, we've been living the same story for 15 years, and suddenly the story had changed, and we had changed it. Not just for the Sodhi family, but for the Sikh community. Rana Sodhi, I think, was modeling a new way forward, fighting for dignity, not as victims, but as peacemakers. And yet, I want to be clear, Rana and I were left unsatisfied. Mm-hmm. The call you just heard wasn't forgiveness said and done. This was the starting point. We don't yet know if Frank is going to be fully responsible for the murder he took, the life that he took.
What do you mean fully responsible?
Well, if you notice at the very beginning, he talked a lot about how he never intentionally meant to kill Balbir Singh Sodhi.
Right, he's kind of overtaken by rage.
Yes, but we don't know what might prevent him from being overtaken by rage today. I mean, the fact that hate violence continues 15 years after 9/11 means that this is more than a crime of passion. This is deep-seated racial and religious bigotry that finds its expression in violence. But what does it take to solve that? And I think what Rana is showing us is that forgiveness is not forgetting. Forgiveness is a starting point for justice, because when we are free from hate, then we can go after the root conditions that make that violence possible.
What surprised you most about the conversation, and what's been the reaction from Sikhs who've heard it?
When Frank Roque says, "When I go to heaven to be judged by God, I will ask to see your brother and I will embrace him and I will ask for forgiveness," I began to weep. And when Rana said, "Well, we already forgave you, Frank," my heart began to ache. I was watching both of them struggle to take a step toward one another. From Orlando to Tulsa to Charlotte to Chelsea to New York, people are tired of endless cycles of violence. But this call is modeling love that is revolutionary.
Lawyer, activist, and filmmaker Valerie Kaur. Her documentary is Divided We Fall, Americans in the Aftermath. And we have the full conversation between Valerie, Rana, and Frank Roque up on our website. It's definitely worth your time. You can find it at PRI.org. Let's take a moment to give you a little background for today's Google Doodle. You know that drawing or animation at Google.com? Today they're tipping their hat to El Santo. He was a professional wrestler in Mexico, the star of Lucha Libre, as wrestling is known there. And even though he's been dead for over 30 years, El Santo remains an icon for many Mexicans. So here's what you need to know. The name El Santo means the saint. For four decades, he always wore a silver mask and refused to reveal his identity. Legend has it he even wore the mask at home and had a special mask made so he could eat more comfortably. El Santo's wrestling career was long, 50 years in the ring. He started in the 1930s, then attracted national attention in the 40s. His timing couldn't have been more impeccable. He started winning high-profile matches just as Lucha Libre began to be televised in Mexico. But TV stardom was just the start. El Santo soon became a comic book hero, his character always seeking justice for the poor and marginalized. Then, in the 1950s, the hero in the silver mask made his movie debut. All of El Santo's movies were basically Mexican kick flicks, short on dialogue and long on epic fight scenes set to campy music. All the while, El Santo kept on wrestling, challenging opponents to unmask him if they could. They never did. El Santo retired, his identity still a mystery, in 1982. During an interview on Mexican TV in 1984, he did lift the mask to reveal his face. And eventually his real name also became known, Rodolfo Guzman Huerta. Also in that interview, El Santo dismissed the toll wrestling took on his body over all those years.
Le doy gracias a Dios que me fui limpiecito a la lucha libre. Me fui nada más únicamente deshecho de las rodillas.
I thank God my body is in pretty good shape, he said, except for my knees, my elbows, my ankles, all of my bones, and a fracture in my skull. I was lucky, I guess, he added. 10 days after that interview, El Santo died from a heart attack, age 66, and he was buried wearing his mask. You're with the world. I know eating meat is bad for the environment, but it's also a habit that's hard to kick as a society. A lot of people aren't convinced that a dry veggie burger or a pasty, flappy veggie burger is the answer. That's why this next story really piqued my interest. It's about a Silicon Valley-based company that claims to have hit the jackpot, a veggie burger that it says tastes, feels, and even bleeds like the real thing. And it's already on the menu at a trendy New York restaurant. We sent reporter Sally Herships to put it to the test.
The idea is if we eat less red meat, we need fewer cows, which means a much smaller load for the environment. But pulling off imitation meat that's juicy and rare and yum, that sounds tough. So I convened a panel of 8 diners to try it out at Momofuku Nishi in Manhattan.
8 cheeseburgers plus 1 cheeseburger.
And And who better to judge a burger than a carnivore? Bartiz Cox is from Oklahoma. He says his family grew up buying whole cows from a rancher and storing them in an extra freezer in the garage.
You could put a Fiat in this freezer.
Joining him at the table are Chris Berube and Bridget Burkholder. Both are vegetarians and both are nervous.
Yeah, I actually am very anxious about this in a way that I didn't think I would be.
It's a little weird. The idea of biting into a slab of meat-like substance.
The bar for pleasing all three of these folks is high, but on the other side of the table, it gets even higher.
My favorite hamburger is my mom's.
7-year-old Theo McCabe is here with his twin Tig, 8-year-old brother Callum, and his mom Allison.
I would just say they're very picky eaters.
The kids and the rest of us have plenty of time to mull over what we're about to bite into. The place is busy, and the wait for our meal is about half an hour. But finally, the Impossible Burgers make their entrance, piled high with lettuce, tomato, and cheese.
It looks like it is a real bleeding hunk of meat, so here goes nothing.
We all dig in, and very quickly, the verdict is in.
It's pretty good.
The burgers are a hit. They taste just like the real thing.
It's really, really, really good.
Even the anxious vegetarians give it 2 thumbs up.
This is spooky. This feels like witchcraft.
It isn't witchcraft, but even though they love the burger, some of the diners are still put off by the idea of fake meat created by science, especially one ingredient, heme.
It's interesting when you Google something that's in your meal, and the first thing that comes up is a picture of a molecule.
It does kind of break my if you can't pronounce it, don't eat it rule, since we don't know what it is.
What heme is an iron-bearing molecule that's found in hemoglobin. It's what makes our blood red. For a response to the other concerns, I had to leave my friends at the restaurant behind.
If pronunciation is an issue, you know, read the ingredients in a cow.
Patrick Brown is the founder of Impossible Foods, the company that created the burger. He says a lot of the food we love only exists because of collaborations between humans and nature.
To make a loaf of bread, you don't just pull up a wheat plant and grab some random microbes and mush them together and munch them down.
Brown first dreamed up the Impossible Burger 7 years ago when he wanted to work on the most important problem in the world that he could contribute to solving, food made from animals. He says all the ingredients in the burger are natural, even heme. Meat has a lot of heme. It's what gives it its meaty taste. But other organisms also have a tiny bit. And that's what makes the Impossible Burger possible. Yeast that's been genetically tweaked to produce huge amounts of heme. And Brown says it's heme that will help draw in the skeptics.
Deliver a big, red, juicy, meaty burger so that the person who's craving that can get exactly what they want.
Eating his burger instead of beef, says Brown, saves as much water as skipping a 10-minute shower, frees 75 square feet of land, and prevents as much greenhouse pollution as you'd create driving 18 miles. Bonus, it has as much iron and protein as the real deal, but no cholesterol. All of which leads brand consultant Eric Yoakumstaller to ask,
yeah, but so what?
Yoakumstaller is what you might call skeptical about the burger's chance of success.
If you just have achieved a matching on taste, and if you now tell me that the reason for that is because of social responsibility and or some other sort of larger environmental benefits, really?
Yoakumstaller says making a veggie burger taste the same as meat isn't good enough, because he says most consumers just don't care that much about the environment. So, if vegetarians are freaked out by meat grown by science and everyone else is hell-bent on wrecking the earth, is anyone going to buy this burger? Maybe the Chinese.
I think they could accept it pretty easily.
Qian Lam Ko is author of Phoenix Claws and Jade Trees, the cookbook. We're having lunch far south of Momofuku Nishi in Chinatown. The place is vegetarian, so we order imitation pork ribs and fake fish.
Chinese have been making imitation meat for, I would say, millennia. You can actually buy mock spam in China, mock chicken, mock pork.
But Ko says most of it is being eaten by vegetarians. The real trick would be to attract some of the millions of carnivores contributing to China's current meat boom. But although it might sound tough to overcome our primal desire to eat the same thing our ancestors chased down, Impossible Foods' Patrick Brown says, before we decide to pass up imitation meat, we should think twice about the real thing.
If anyone still has the illusion that there's anything natural about where their beef comes from, it doesn't take a tremendous amount of research to realize that there's almost nothing remotely natural about how it's produced.
Besides, Brown says, while cows aren't getting better at making beef, the Impossible Burger is going to continue to improve. Meanwhile, back at Momofuku Nishi, there's one burger left, almost untouched. 7-year-old Callum says he loved it, but he filled up on French fries. And despite the skepticism, you can tell everyone at the table wants to take it home. For The World, Sally Herships, New York.
If you need to see it to believe it, you can check out photos from Sally's trip at PRI.org. I personally have no problems with a vegan burger or a veggie burger. Gotta keep an open mind, you know. Same with the blues. It originated in the Mississippi Delta, but I'll take it from anywhere. Like Mauritius, the former French colony. Yeah, you heard me right. Mauritius blues, right from the middle of the Indian Ocean. I don't know what that wild, sobbing instrument is, but the voice you're about to hear belongs to a Mauritian artist who was big there in the 1970s. Stage name, Til Afrique, real name, Roger Fatim. This track, called Soul Sock Sega, embraces the loping sound in Mauritius known as Sega, but it's also a straight-up funky 12-bar blues. Count them out and follow the changes. Litia moitié Roland, papizette au timide pour te mettre, ni ça pour faire nous content. Pour j'allais ton bras, mon apatimi. Pour connaître si mon basse ou, pour pouvoir les mots danser, tout pour content. Wow! Oh, Mr. Brown! Mr. Brown! Oh, Mr. Brown! Oh, Mr. Brown! Mr. Brown! Music there from a new collection called Soul Sock Sega, Sega Sounds from Mauritius, 1973 to 79. What was that sound? In a moment, we catch up with two of the new MacArthur Genius Fellows here on The World.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from TIAA. Whether it's investing, advice, banking, or retirement, TIAA is dedicated to helping those who teach, heal, and serve others achieve a lifetime of financial well-being. More at TIAA.com.
I'm Marco Werman. Happy Fredags Taco. That's Norwegian for Taco Friday. You know, just Norwegians making some tacos, relaxing their way into the weekend.
There are many things that's a bit, that are a bit weird here in Norway, so I don't get surprised too much anymore.
An Italian eats tacos in Norway on a Friday. That's ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. 23 people recently got phone calls that changed their lives. I'm talking about the 2016 MacArthur Fellows. The so-called genius grants get awarded every year to what the foundation calls extraordinary individuals. And full disclosure here, the MacArthur Foundation also supports our parent company, PRI. We're going to hear from two of this year's MacArthur Fellows. In a few minutes, we'll talk with someone who works to connect low-income immigrants to mainstream financial services. First up, though, Ahilan Arul Ananthem. He's a human rights lawyer with the ACLU of Southern California in Los Angeles. And his work focuses on expanding the rights of immigrant detainees. So, Ahilan, thanks for being with us. How'd you find out you won?
I got a phone call. It's really surreal, actually. It was a very busy day. I had to file some papers in our case about counsel for children facing deportation. So I ignored the call about three or four times. And then they called through and they said they were a foundation. I wasn't paying much attention. I was just wondering who this pesky caller was. So I tried to put them through to our development office. And they said, no, we need to talk to you. And then they said they wanted a few minutes to have a confidential conversation. And it was very exciting.
Deportations have actually gone up under President Obama. How hard has your work been in the last 8 years?
It's been extremely hard. So most recently, There are thousands of refugee children, mostly from Honduras, Guatemala, and El Salvador, who have fled extreme violence and come to this country, often alone. And the administration's response has been to put those children into deportation proceedings without giving them lawyers. And they pay a trained prosecutor to argue against the child in every case. But only about half the children end up having lawyers, and that's through a set of programs that have done great work, but it leaves the other half out in the cold.
Mm. You actually won this award right after losing a case that was addressing the right of kids to a lawyer. Tell us about that case.
Yes, the timing was somewhat ironic. It was a case on behalf of children in deportation proceedings, just arguing that because the government pays a prosecutor in every case, they should also pay a lawyer to represent the child. And our clients, 13, 14-year-old children, and in some cases even younger. There's one boy, he was 3. And unfortunately, yes, an appellate court ruled essentially that the case couldn't be brought as a class action and that it had to be brought individually and not even by a lawyer, that only unrepresented children who don't have lawyers in the immigration process are the only ones in the position to make this argument for themselves. And, you know, we disagree with that ruling. We thought it was both wrong and unfair.
You've said that your law career has been influenced by your own family's experience. Tell us about that. I know they're from Sri Lanka, right?
Yeah, I was born here, but my parents are from Sri Lanka. And when I was 10 years old, the civil war started in Sri Lanka. And at that time, most of my extended family had to flee the country, and they came to live with us. And for several years, we had my cousins, my aunts and uncles, and then other people who were more distantly related, and then some who weren't related at all. And this wasn't just my parents. I mean, there were a lot of people in the Sri Lankan Tamil community trying to protect loved ones who were fleeing the violence. And that was a formative experience for me. And when I say I wish people could think about refugee and immigration problems just by putting themselves into the shoes of those who have to leave, I'm often thinking of my own family.
You know, as you mentioned that, I think of Donald Trump's campaign, which has gotten a lot of support, and we know that because the race is tight. And I'm going to assume, I don't think unfairly, that many of his supporters, like Trump himself, have forebears who emigrated to this country. You talk about getting Americans putting themselves in the shoes of immigrants today. Why do you think that's so hard to do?
That's a great question. I think it's absolutely a problem of memory and how we define ourselves, you know, and people who say it's about breaking the law and when we came legally. I would love to just have 10 minutes to talk to those people about the history of the immigration law. And there's no federal immigration law until 1875. There's no quotas on immigrants coming from the entire Western Hemisphere until the 1950s. And so the notion that my grandparents or great-grandparents would never have done this is almost always not true.
Ahilan, what case are you most proud of?
I'm blessed to have several that I am happy about. If I had to pick one, there was a client of mine who shares my name, Ahilan. His last name was Nataraja, and he was a Sri Lankan Tamil refugee who fled really horrific violence and was wrongly labeled a national security threat by our government. And as a result, he was kept in immigration detention for 4.5 years.
Wow.
From 2001 to 2006. And ultimately, we won his case and he got out. He became a U.S. citizen. He married. He has a child and is living a perfectly productive life in California, actually.
In your law practice, do you have kind of a sense in your mind of what your mission is?
Yes. My mission is to harmonize the immigration laws with our values and our constitutional principles applicable in other contexts.
Sounds pretty straightforward.
Yeah. I actually think there's nothing particularly genius about it. It shouldn't take it doesn't take a genius to figure out that if you have a 10-year-old child in a courtroom against a trained prosecutor, if you want to give the child a fair hearing, you should probably give them a lawyer. Or if you're going to lock somebody up for 3 or 4 years, you should probably have a hearing in front of a judge to decide if that's really necessary. And these are the principles that we're fighting for. They're not especially complicated.
Ahilan Arul Anatham is a director of advocacy and legal director at the ACLU of Southern California in Los Angeles and one of 23 MacArthur Grant recipients. Congratulations, Ahilan, and thank you.
Thank you very much.
Another of this year's recipients of the MacArthur Foundation's Genius Grants is Jose Quiñones. He's being recognized for his work connecting low-income immigrants to mainstream financial services. Sounds like it could be a little bland, but it's an absolutely critical service, and his is an absolutely genius solution. Quiñones' nonprofit organization, the Mission Asset Fund, tracks informal loans and helps new Americans build credit history. Jose Quiñones, welcome and congratulations.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
So most of us, including myself, take for granted being able to live with credit. So describe for us the basic problems of someone who doesn't have a credit history, somebody who's emigrating to this country, for example.
Yeah, you know, it's a big problem, particularly for new immigrants, new people kind of coming into the financial mainstream, not having a credit score, or credit report. It's sort of like not having a passport to enter into the financial mainstream, right? Where without the credit score, credit report, you know, they're denied at every turn. Without a credit report nowadays, you know, people can get apartments. In some cases, without a credit report, they can't even get a job because employers are looking at credit reports to decide on who to hire, or landlords are looking at that to decide on who to rent. So credit reports actually has become one of those very important documents that people need in order to navigate and to do the things they need to do to live, you know, and thrive in society.
Right. And it's not as if these people don't have any credit history. It's just a credit history that's not recognized legally in this country. So how do you help?
Exactly. So, you know, one of the things that we realize that, you know, particularly when we're working with low-income immigrants is that, you know, they have a very different ways of saving and managing money that in ways that we typically don't recognize in our society. And one of the ways that they do this is there's a rich tradition in immigrant communities of coming together to lend and save money together. In Mexico, they call this activity called the contandas cundinas. All throughout the Caribbean, they call them susus. And all over the world, they have a lot of different names for it. But really, the activity is exactly the same, where people, you know, say a group of 10 individuals that come together and they all agree to put in, for example, like $100 a month or about, you know, or every week, and then they pool $1,000, and then somebody then takes $1,000, and then they do it again the following week or the following month, and then somebody else takes the pot of money, and they do that in rotation until everybody gets a chance of getting that the pot of money. And so this is a way of people, again, lending and saving money together. But this is an activity that is invisible to the financial mainstream. It's an activity that nobody really knows about except the people that are doing it. And so what we did with MAF is created a program, Lending Circles, where we actually are formalizing.
That's the Mission Asset Fund, MAF.
Yeah, the Mission Asset. We're formalizing the activity with Lending Circles, where we ask people to sign a promissory note. And then that promissory note becomes like the legal document that makes that activity visible to the credit system, right? It is a paper that says, here's a promise of them putting $100 and the promise of us giving them $1,000. And then through that document, we then have standing to then report and service that loan and report it to the credit bureaus. And by reporting to the credit bureaus, we're helping people establish or improve their credit scores so that they have then the ability to then do whatever they need to do in their lives, whether it's rent an apartment or buy a house or buy a car or get a loan to start a business or whatever it is that they want to do. Now they have the tool to actually, you know, become, you know, economic actors in our system.
Jose, tell us about one of your success stories.
You know, there's so many, frankly. I mean, we've worked with over 6,000 people over the years, but, you know, there's one story that really always gets to me because this is, you know, this was one of our clients who moved from Chicago to San Francisco after leaving her abusive, you know, husband. And she moved to San Francisco with her two kids, trying to reestablish her new life by herself. But because she, you know, she didn't have a bank or credit history, she couldn't find any apartment for her to live. And so she was essentially homeless for some time, sometimes sleeping in hallways with her kids. But it wasn't until she was able to get a credit report that she was able to actually get an apartment for her to start her new life again. And so her story is really meaningful because when she came to us and to let us know about how she found an apartment that she could afford and she was able to get it because of that report, I mean, she was literally in tears when she was telling us that. Wow. And then we cut into tears because, you know, all she needed was that one document for her to, like, you know, reestablish herself again.
We just spoke with one of your fellow grant recipients, Ahilan Arul Anandam, who's doing legal work on behalf of immigrants. And as I went through the list of MacArthur Fellows this year, there are at least five recipients from my count, including yourself, who are focused on the lives of people in the shadows of American society, immigrants. Is this just coincidence?
You know, I hope not. I hope that we use this moment to really step back and recognize the fullness of America, really to recognize, you know, the breadth of our diversity and how, you know, even people in the shadows are making America great now. And I'm glad that that's the case, because I really hope that that's the message that we need to send out, you know, because that's exactly what we're doing with our work. We're trying to show, you know, the dignity of people's lives, to show that they have the wherewithal, the ability and capacity to live out full lives. But we need to have, you know, give them some help to make sure that actually, you know, is impactful. So I'm glad to hear that. I'm glad to know that, because I think as Americans, we need to step back and really recognize the richness of what we are, including those people that are at the margins.
Jose Quinones, the recipient of a genius grant from the MacArthur Foundation for his work helping people build credit history. Thanks for your time and congratulations again.
Thank you.
A week ago, there was rare hope in Syria, hope that a ceasefire would be extended and that a more lasting solution to the war there could be found. But now, as this week ends, the fighting in Syria has resumed on all fronts. And Aleppo, the country's second largest city, is once again under fire. Government forces have pounded rebel-held areas, readying for a ground offensive to retake the city. Monther Itaki is a journalist in Aleppo. My BBC colleague Mike Thompson managed to reach him via Skype.
Can you tell me how bad the bombing has been since the breakdown of the ceasefire?
There is a huge and heavy attacks on the civilians' areas in Aleppo. Not like before anymore. They attack it with phosphor and cannons, shellings and airstrikes and barrel bombs. So what's horrible, hearing all these explosions. Warplanes won't leaving the sky all the night. My little baby can't sleep, and my wife too. The warplanes, they are attacking over our heads.
Eastern Aleppo has been under siege for most of the last 2 months. How short of food are you and drinking water?
Water is hard to get and food, it's not enough. And the market, it's empty. There's no vegetables or fruits and baby's milk. It's not available anymore. I searched for 5 days, but I didn't find anything. And I was in danger because warplanes all the day, they are flying over the city.
What do you think is going to happen now in the coming months? What will be the future for East Aleppo?
Assad regime is trying every day to making siege more harder. That's what's happening in Aleppo. And nothing can change if that's international community is still silent and not saying anything about that.
Monther Itaki, a journalist in Aleppo, Syria. He was speaking there with the BBC's Mike Thompson. I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. It started out with stickers, placed over street signs in the Canadian city of Toronto. And on those stickers were the indigenous names of the streets and the areas those streets run through. For 3 years, members of the Ogima Makana Project posted these informal reminders of what the First Nations called these places long ago. They made billboards, street signs, and plaques, and their work did not go unnoticed, because now there are 4 streets in Toronto that officially go by their indigenous names, from the Anishinaabe tribe. Hayden King is a co-founder of this project and a member of the Anishinaabe. Hayden, why does it matter to you what these street names are actually called?
Well, I think that there's been a very long history in Canada of erasing Indigenous presence. And I think that this is especially true in cities. I think Canadians often think of Native people living, you know, in the north or in the hinterland or on reserve or in reservations, and kind of overlook the fact that there are tens of thousands of Indigenous peoples living in Canadian cities that have always been living in Canadian cities before colonization and certainly after. So, you know, we hope to correct that erasure, you know, like reinsert ourselves into the landscape and remind Canadians that they're on Indigenous land.
Give us an example, then, of what one street used to be called, say its post-colonial name and the indigenous name it's been changed back to.
There are a few different ways that we go about namings. In some cases, we might literally translate a street name. So we take a street that has actually indigenous origins, like Spadina Avenue, actually comes from the Anishinaabemowin word for a place on a hill. So we just corrected it back to the original Anishinaabemowin, which is Ishpadina. Or we'll bring back a name for a road. The oldest road in Toronto was a portage between two rivers in the city that Haudenosaunee and Anishinaabe people used. So we gave it back its old name, Gedi Onagaming, you know, the old portage.
In some cases, you actually renamed the street. In other cases, you went back to the original indigenous name?
That's right.
So Canada's First Nations, did they have naming conventions back in the day? Would they actually give a path or a street a name?
Absolutely. And, you know, we do research to corroborate our translations and to figure out the original place names. It's actually a fairly significant amount of work. And we rely on historical documents, primary documents, archaeological information, also elders, oral histories, oral narratives. And anytime we do a translation, wherever in the territory we go, we're sure to run the translation by a local elder to make sure that it's accurate.
So you've been putting these stickers on street signs for about 3 years. Why do you think these signs got officially changed now?
It's a good question. I mean, we've been doing this in a sort of provocative, illegal way, really. We've been taking down official Toronto signs and replacing them with our own. And there was a group of people, they're called a business improvement area. We took over an intersection in their neighborhood, and they approached us and asked us to tell them about the project. We obliged, and that started a relationship, and they asked our permission if they could go the formal route to get the street signs changed. We didn't believe it would happen at first because, as I said, you know, there's this history of erasure and a persistent inclination by state and settlers to ignore Indigenous people, but they went ahead with it, and I think that, you know, they wanted to acknowledge Indigenous history, and, you know, we're in this era of supposed reconciliation in Canada, and I got to give them a lot of credit.
So could this happen in other cities in Canada, in the United States, maybe?
I don't see why not. I mean, I would encourage activists and educators, Indigenous activists and educators, to push their narratives and to reinsert themselves into the landscape and Canadian and American consciousness in whatever means possible.
Hayden King, a co-founder of the Ogima Makana Project and a member of the Anishinaabe tribe, thanks very much.
Miigwech.
Miigwech.
Ojibwe, thank you.
And finally today, if you need an idea for dinner tonight, I've got a Norwegian dish for you, tacos. Mm-hmm. Norwegians are crazy about them, and every Friday night is taco night in Norway. People invite friends over and share a meal. For an outsider, an invite means you've broken into the famously reserved local culture. That's a word from Alice Ciccone. She's originally from Italy, but calls Oslo home now. She says Friday tacos just make sense there.
I mean, most of the people like to eat tacos anyway, so why not to do it once per week?
Yeah. So there was this Norwegian tabloid that ran a study a few years ago and found that nearly 10% of the country does this. I mean, how did such a huge population just say, we're all going to eat tacos on Friday night?
Well, I actually heard that in 2011, 50% of people eat tacos at least once per month.
Wow. Okay. So that number is kind of flexible, obviously.
Yeah, I don't know. But I was reading some things in the news, and it seems like also people wonder about the same thing. And it's like the answer is generally, why not? It's a very easy food to make. It's really good. Every member of the family likes it because you can basically choose whatever you want in your tacos. And yeah, so it's something that it's very easy to do and to eat.
How many Norwegians do you think have actually eaten authentic tacos?
Yeah, I don't know. I don't even know if I haven't eaten authentic tacos. This is a bit a problem of every, like, exotic food that we experience in a different country. As an Italian abroad, don't ask me if anyone has ever experienced Italian food, really.
Right, because you can't get real Italian food unless you're in Italy.
Yeah, or unless an Italian makes it.
Well, there is a big difference between tacos that you find in Mexico and tacos that you find in the United States and certainly in Oslo. When you first heard about Fredag's Taco, did you think it was a joke?
Well, there are many things that are a bit weird here in Norway, so I don't get surprised too much anymore.
What is a normal dinner, if we can find a dinner that is normal in Norway these days?
Well, most of people say the most eaten food in Norway is pizza. I mean, the traditional dinner is made of meatballs, fish, potatoes, and vegetable. But people are getting used to eat very different kind of food. So a bit as my idea of an American culture is that people eat different kind of food from different countries every day, every week or something like that. So pizza is very common. Taco is apparently very common. And pasta as well. So, I mean, it's very variated. And I think also sushi is very popular in Norway.
Yeah, the great Norwegian tradition of pizza and sushi.
Yes.
So if you go back to Italy, are you going to take the Taco Friday tradition with you?
I actually do it. I really like it. And it's, I mean, I don't know if we can really call it taco, but it's a nice way to share a meal with friends, and it's very colorful, and everybody can make their own plate and decide what to eat, so it's very convenient as well.
Yeah, well, just like the Korean taco trucks here in the United States, you could do an Italian spin, like zucchini flowers and mozzarella inside a taco.
Why not?
Alice Ciccone, originally from Italy, now calls Oslo home. You're going to eat tacos tonight?
Why not? You gave me a good idea.
Okay. Bon appetit.
Bon appetito.
And that'll do it for us today, this Fredags. Our theme music was composed by Eric Goldberg from the Nana Bill Harris Studios at WGBH here in Boston. I'm Marco Werman. Have yourselves a great weekend.
PRI, Public Radio International.